if you can tap into enough of a cultural impulse, you know, you can become the voice of that cultural moment. And I think that's what garners the most attention.
Hello, welcome to a new episode of The Influence Factor by The Influencer Marketing Factory. Today with me, we have Brandon Rothen, that is the Chief Marketing Officer at Ground Truth. If you're new to the show, I wanted to invite you to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Be updated on new episodes every single Wednesday. Enjoy the episode. Hey, Brandon, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. You were just telling me now that you are like, you know, busy weeks, but exciting ones, right? With all the things, closing H1, getting into like H2, I guess that it's normal, right? For you, you get used to, right?
You know, but that's marketing, right? You're always running from the thing to thing. So that's what we're doing right now.
Exactly. You know, especially now, you know, that we're recording, you know, summertime, maybe like, you know, it's the time where you can get, you know, used to then it could be Q3 and Q4. That for marketing is crazy, right? Like it's everything is happening basically in a couple of months, and you have to get ready times like in advance. So
totally, yeah. You're trying to close out the year strong, but also, you know, we're in kind of a weird spot right now where the economy is kind of on the teeter of something. So everyone's either panicking trying to get everything done, or they're worried and trying to be conservative. There's like no in between, and that's just what you got to deal with. That's life.
I know. I feel you on that, and. So, you know, usually what I do at the beginning of the podcast episode, of course, you know, I ask about the guest, you know, so, you know, who is the person, right? That is like, you know, professionally speaking or personal side, you know, how did you, you know, build your career so far? So can you tell us, you know, for me and the audience today, who are you? How did you get to that, you know, point where you are right now?
Yeah, I think you'd have to go back a little bit to what got me into marketing in the first place. You know, I was a biology major through most of college. I like cause and effect. I like experimentation. I like, you know, seeing what happens when I do a thing. And that sort of led me to an agency that ultimately, after I stopped doing biology and started doing marketing, it led me to an agency where they were okay with trial and error. They were okay with, you know, testing things. They were okay with experimenting and pushing the boundaries. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what I've done at every stop, I think. Is try to push the boundaries and change the brand, hopefully, so ultimately people pay attention to it. You know, I've got a saying that I've thrown around a lot to my teams: boring kills brands. And I think you got to be really interesting, and you got to push at the envelope, and you have to ultimately do things that get you attention. So at Wendy's, at Papa John's, at Potbelly, and even now at Ground Truth, I'm very proud of the work my team's doing that's getting attention and breaking through and ultimately driving sales because of that attention. So I think you had to say, who am I? I'm the guy who likes breaking things, I guess, and making things hopefully interesting.
I love it. And, you know, you've been, you know, really humble, you know, during the presentation, but for people listening, I mean, you have been, and just reading here, right, just to be 100% sure and, you know, that I'm correct, but VP of Advertising, Media, Digital, Social Media for Wendy's. You've been the global CMO for Papa John's, and you also played like the same role also at Potbelly, right? So, I mean, you know, it's like, you know, not just the first company out there, right? So congratulations on that, first of all. And then I wanted to ask you, you know, what are you really proud of? If there is any specific campaigns or anything that you're working on and you were like, you know, I killed at that time with my team. It was amazing. It went on major publication. It was, you know, a blast. And then secondly, what did you learn from each of these experiences?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm a big believer you have to diagnose the problem that's there and try to fix it to ultimately make a company grow. And generally, the companies I've joined are ones that are struggling to grow when they bring me on. So the work I'm probably best known for is building the digital social team and brand at Wendy's. So I was very fortunate that when I started there, you know, the management that was in place was very willing to push boundaries, was very willing to experiment, to try something to break free and get back to growth. Mm-hmm. And I got the, you know, honor, I would say, to help rebrand Wendy's, rework the approach that it was taking, especially in digital social, which led us to getting a lot of attention very quickly as that team got online and started to really break through and get attention, especially in places like Twitter. And then they kept giving me more stuff to do because it worked. So I ultimately took over all advertising there, media, social, but also traditional, and extremely proud of the work the team did over the, you know, 5-6 years that I got to build out that world. And And even from that team and later from Papa John's, where I was brought in to do something similar, rework that brand, you know, I've got seven people that worked for me or worked with me that are now CMOs. So it's awesome when you get to build something great that gets enough external attention and ultimately makes a brand grow substantially, so you can build that kind of record and ultimately build out teams that can be successful going forward. So I would say most proud of the Wendy's work. Having said that, this, what we ended up doing at Papa John's, reworking that brand was the kind of work that led to I'm actually a Papa John's franchisee because of it. It grew so much that I wanted to personally invest in that company. And then at Potbelly, reworked the menu, reworked the offering there. And that led to, you know, I think they just celebrated their eighth or ninth quarter of growth on the back of that work. So I'm most proud of growth, basically. The fact that you can come into a company that is struggling a bit, make some changes, sometimes very hard changes, and you can experience the kind of growth that everyone benefits from. Franchisees, the corporate organization benefits from it. I would argue the world benefits from it because you have a brand that shouldn't be great that's now, you know, gaining in the world again. So very proud of that and very proud of the people that were able to grow along with it, like those folks that are now CMOs.
Amazing. How did social media change it in the years? Like, are you seeing many, like, you know, what are the biggest differences and changes and things that either shocked you or you were not expecting or something that you're like, oh, finally, like, you know, we were missing that a few years ago and now it's there. So is there anything that you're lacking or liking when it comes to social media nowadays?
Yeah. Well, I think in the very early days, social, for at least for brands, was just a commercial outlet. It was republishing what you did in other channels. It was oftentimes blunt promotion of your product. And what I think we were able to do at Wendy's, and others did it as well, but what we were able to do at Wendy's and breakthrough was actually use the platform as sort of a tool to create a brand personality, something that was bigger and more interesting and more human, I would argue. So I think that was a significant breakthrough when companies began to look at social and ultimately the way customers interact and consumers, period, interact with social and be more human and actually have a personality. I think what's evolved since that breakthrough that happened in the early 2010s when we and other brands like us began to do that, was now it went from corporate kind of sterile world to now almost everybody has a personality. And I'd argue that's all you follow anymore in social is personalities. You don't really follow brands. Maybe there's the odd example like Nike that you might follow just brand because it's so ubiquitous. But by and large, people follow personalities, which makes moments for companies like Duolingo to break through and get attention because the personality is so strong that people want to follow the personality. I think the most recent changes are starting to be more about quality and less about quantity of content. There was a time that, you know, you used to just blitzkrieg every platform with whatever you could to figure out what works. There's a lot of trial and error. But now that there's so much out there and the tools are so much better, and I would argue people are more sophisticated, especially marketers, the platforms, the BS is kind of doesn't work anymore. So you really have to define your personality. You really have to engage your customers in a much more real way. And you can use production to your advantage as a brand. You know, it used to be raw was all people cared about. And now, you know, a well-done video, for example, can work really well as long as it's suitable for the platform and suitable for your audience and fits your personality. So I think the next step in social is brands kind of growing up past just be, I don't know if the word snarky or outrageous, okay, and be more interesting, genuinely interesting. Because there are a lot of brands that are genuinely interesting. And if you can embrace that and make that personality come forward in a more real way on social, I think it's much more legitimate for long-term success rather than just be outrageous.
Yeah,
dropping an on Twitter used to get you all kinds of attention as a brand. I think we've grown past that, fortunately.
Yeah. I do remember like all the Twitter, like, you know, the news jacking, you know, things like that, right? Getting there at the real time, you know, basically being the first one. But yeah, I do agree. Like we all almost got a peak, right, in that type of content. Now people are like getting used to. So it's not anymore that you know, drastic as an approach slash, you know, it's not anymore that unique, I would say, right? So I do agree, you know, with you on that. And we will go more about, you know, like vanity metrics later on. We're going to talk about like, you know, likes, all these things that, you know, they're nice, but on the P&L, they might not, you know, make a huge difference sometimes. But before doing that, after that, I read, you know, one of the, you know, interview that you did. So I will quote it, okay? And I would like to know how did you manage that? But you said this. I will, you know, quote, you know, just word by word. You said, we used to joke at Papa Joe's that snow was liquid gold because when it snows, pizza sales go nuts. You have a bad winter and sales go up by low single digits, just like that, okay? So first of all, I love it about the liquid gold. You know, it's a nice way to put it like that. And then I was really interested, when that happened, like, were you using any, you know, weather programmatic tools to understand that? Were you pushing that? Was it more like a natural? And so, like, how important it is to also understanding what happens around you, not only online, to bring people offline and in-store?
Yeah, so, you know, marketers like to think that we are 100% of the influence of people's behavior, but we're not. It's just the world does what the world does. You know, the pandemic was a great example of that just certain businesses went crazy because the need was there and it wasn't before. And specifically, you know, at a lot of delivery foods do really well when the weather's bad because people just don't want to go out and eat. It's just simple logic, right? And the opposite is true, where drive-throughs actually do worse when the weather's bad, you know, and sit-down restaurants because people don't want to leave the house when it's gross. So I do think as a marketer, it's really important for you to isolate the variables that you can control and understand the influence that you have on those variables so you can truly understand what your media, what your marketing is doing to benefit your brand. I think you have to have good controls. You have to look at trend changes, not day-to-day sales. You have to compare those trend changes to a control so you have a really good sense of what your influence really looks like. So, you know, it feels old school, but I still run pre-post net of control studies all the time, like every month with clients through Ground Truth, because I want to isolate, you know, the individual stimulus that's in play, like media or whatever it is, and understand its impact. And I think beyond that, you know, you asked a very good question, like, do you do something with those external factors like weather? Absolutely. We used to scale, and I, you know, I still do in some businesses that I worked with, you'd scale media associated with, you know, external phenomena. If you know it's going to storm over the weekend and your sales are really strong on Friday and Saturday nights, typically, you boost your SEM. You make sure you're out there in social and pushing. If you have a promotion that's available, you make sure everybody knows the promotion exists. You know, you do the things you need to do. In fact, at the company I'm at now, Ground Truth, we have weather triggering. It literally automatically serves ads with higher scale as soon as the weather starts to shift, because we know a lot of businesses directly benefit from it. And you can actually do the opposite too if weather hurts you. So, you know, right now I work with clients right now that if they know their sales are going to stink over the weekend because it's going to storm all weekend, you ramp advertising on Tuesday, Wednesday so you can get some pre-sales, offset the losses on the weekend, and then you come back in on Monday afternoon when the rain stops or whatever it is, storm, whatever it is, so you can recover some of that business. I think it's really important for marketers to isolate their impact, but also maximize what they can accomplish based on external factors they can't control. And I think it lets you tell a much more transparent and realistic story to your organization, because then you can say, you know, we did the work that isolates the effect of what's happening, and we're not taking credit for things that we didn't, you know, cause, but we can adjust for things that you know, will impact us negatively or positively. So I think it's totally critical. If you're purely using day-to-day sales, like every morning you wake up and you look at your sales report and that's what you're using to measure your marketing, I think you're kidding yourself. It's just, the world is more complicated.
Is your brand ready to amplify its reach? Well, the Influencer Marketing Factory is here for you. We are a global influencer marketing agency helping brands ignite their growth. From influencer identification to campaign strategy, handling legalities and agreements, to managing shipping and logistics, we got you all covered. We work with hundreds of brands across different verticals, from Fortune 500 companies to direct-to-consumer brands. And we don't just stop there. With detailed ROI analysis, we help brands like yours measure success transforming impressions into conversions. You can find us at theinfluencermarketingfactory.com or just searching The Influencer Marketing Factory on Google. Of course, no, brilliant analysis on that. Thank you for that. And, you know, like when you said about, you know, factors that you cannot really, you know, like maybe control, but be ready, right? Before it's too late, you already crashed the car, basically, right? You know, against the wall. And, you know, to jumping back on what we were saying before, you know, I liked when all the time you say that, you know, I mean, of course, vanity metrics can be very important for, like, you know, only a part of the marketing that you're doing. But at the end of the day, and again, just to quote you again, you said, like, your CFO won't care about likes, you know? You have to correlate that to traffic, sales, of course, right, and so on. So I wanted to ask you, especially, like, going from online social media to offline food traffic, for example, for restaurants, and you have so much knowledge on that. How do you do that? How do you track it properly? How do you, you know, get back to your, you know, maybe digital marketing, you know, like, person and be like, this is the actual ROI of this campaign because of these people went to the restaurant or the order and so on. How do you do that?
Yeah, so I think it's really important to just to start with what is the problem you're trying to solve. Mm-hmm. Not everything is solvable through a bigger presence on a social platform, but let me use a real example. So, you know, at Wendy's, the problem we were trying to solve essentially was we had an older demographic that was our loyalists, people who knew Dave Thomas, who was on TV in the 80s and 90s. And we didn't have a younger demographic that was generally going to places like Chipotle and Five Guys. They were going to, you know, fast casual places and less and less fast food like Wendy's, more traditional. So if you isolate your problem, then you can create a measurement that actually matters. And what we were looking at then was as we began to scale our social presence and scale our digital media and pull some back from traditional media, we were looking at the perception of that specific demo we were trying to attract. So we could see in the numbers that, yes, we were getting more younger people and more younger people were paying attention to and talking about the brand. That, to me, is a strong leading indicator that we're solving the real problem. And it doesn't happen immediately. There's a delayed effect. We all know this as marketers. You know, sometimes you can do performance marketing and see an immediate conversion. For deeper problems like demographic shifts, which is a big, you know, big longer-term issue, you have to see those leading indicators that say it's starting to work. And then you actually have to keep betting on the things that are creating those leading indicators and ultimately, you know, see it show up in sales in a reasonable time horizon. So the way we did it at Wendy's was we started looking at those demographic shifts as they began to happen from a perception standpoint. I could talk about those, you know, in the organization, and then people started to show up from that demographic. And then you could actually see it in the traffic numbers. It took us, you know, a year and a half of hard work before we really started to see the traffic side show up. Now, sales did increase, you know, relatively quickly once we, you know, had everything working, and it took a while to get it all working. But that shift, you know, takes time. Every company I've been at, you really have to be clear about the problem you're solving. And I would argue sales and traffic are an outcome of solving a larger problem. They are not the actual thing that you can count on as the solve. Now, that's not true in pure performance marketing. Like at Ground Truth, we do run campaigns where it's just about driving foot traffic. And that's okay. If that's what you need, that's okay. But it usually is relatively small. You can see seeing double-digit lifts in like shifts in your business usually is solving a much bigger problem. So I think the short answer is define your problem very clearly and then agree on the measures overall of how to actually affect that problem. And to me, you can't use anything that looks like a marketing metric with your larger organization. You can't say it's impressions or reach or what or likes or whatever it is. You have to decide that, no, the problem's deeper than that, and we're going to use marketing as a tool to solve the problem. And here are the leading indicators that say we're starting to solve it. And then the indicators in the back end are traffic, sales, shifts in the business that we can all agree will come, you know, in a reasonable horizon.
Do you think that this approach can also work with, you know, maybe smaller restaurants and, you know, apart from like, you know, big chains, right? For example, like Wendy's, but do you think that this can be also, you know, used by restaurants, other like big and mortar type of businesses? Do you have any advice maybe for, again, those businesses might not have like, you know, the same budget as a big chain. Is there something similar or something that they can do?
Totally. And you know, the company I'm working for right now, we work with smaller chains all the time and see significant shifts. It usually is about solving that problem, though. And the problem might be as simple as awareness. People just don't know you exist, or they don't know what your offering is. They don't know how you're differentiated. So it's possible the problem is more just like fundamental, that you need you know, to reach the right group of people at the right time to actually create the awareness that gives them the opportunity to come and shop with you. But absolutely, but you do have to define the problem, and you can't just say, you know, I'm going to use a really blunt tool like advertising and just say the brand exists and you're going to solve all your issues. I mean, at Potbelly, for example, Potbelly is not huge. It's about 500 locations, but it's in clusters in the country. So, you know, we were running giant national programs. We actually determined the fundamental issue wasn't advertising. It was our menu. It was our pricing. It was our operations. And as we fixed those things, the business started to come back. So you have to be very clear on what is the reason that people aren't showing up. And if it is awareness, advertising might be a solve, but you can start small. You can start with a specific bullseye target of a demo and see if you're, or a psychographic target is even better, and see, can I make them, you know, can I get them interested and have them show up? And if the answer is yes, you bet on what works and bet on what works and bet on what works. And it's this wonderful snowball of a process. It does take time and it takes a little homework. But I would argue any business can do it.
I like when you say that it's not just about marketing, but also, you know, about things like the items that you have on the menu, right? If we think about so many chains that did like secret menus that went maybe viral on TikTok, right? It's not just about, it's because of the FOMO, right? That it gets you. You won't go there before it expires. You want maybe to have a drop collection of like items on your menu that are going to be all available that month. Or maybe you can do like a collaboration, right, with someone that is an influencer that is going to be, again, like, you know, this scarcity type of thing that is going to be all available during the summer. So I like when you said it's not just the typical display ads, but it's like looking at pricing, how much people want to pay. Can we do a discount for couples for like, you know, one of these, like all these type of things, right? They're not only marketing, but it's product oriented. So.
Yeah. And I really think you got to start with deciding what your problem is. And when you understand your problem, you can tackle that problem from a bunch of different ways to see what works. And when you figure out what works, do more of it. And eventually what you're doing will stop working and if you do something else. So you do have to, though, define your problem very clearly, because especially if you're a smaller brand, you don't have money to waste. Yeah. You have to make very specific decisions about this is what we're going to do. You know, I'm working with a brand right now through Ground Truth that fundamentally, the issue was they weren't advertising to the ideal customer that they should actually be drawing in. They were using broad advertising. They didn't have a whole lot of money. So they were kind of shotgunning across everybody, trying to get, you know, can we get people in? When all we really had to do was focus and say, well, no, who exactly do you want to show up? Like, who is the perfect customer? Well, they look like this. They're more into premium things and they're more interested in the brand offering. So what are you doing using promotions? Mm-hmm. So what are you doing talking to everybody? Why don't we focus on this one group and tell them what you think is the ideal thing for them to hear? And if it works, we'll do more of it. And it worked like a charm. And then we start to see them show up. And then you can start scaling that and expanding it to make sure that you're, you know, reaching all the people that are within that ideal customer base. And then you get the rings around to get the people that are kind of like the ideal customer. I think most people try to either do everything or do like promotions and that's it. And you know, you shop and I shop, we go to a place because we want something there. Not usually because it's cheap, even though sometimes that helps. Not usually because it's just accessible, even though, again, that can help. Usually you're willing to spend a little bit more money on a brand, on a label, on a particular product, because you know it's going to fit what you need and you're going to be proud to buy the thing. And that's our job as marketers, is to make people aware that we can solve their problems, fit their need, but also make them proud to actually, you know, transact with the brand and use the brand. And defining that problem first is really important so you can tackle it appropriately and use your dollars well.
Absolutely. You know, I like when you say about the spray and pray techniques doesn't work, right? You cannot do that. It's a waste of money. And it's crazy to me to think how many brands still, they don't know who is their ideal customer. They don't know. Like, they haven't not identified their personas. So how can you, like, is it through, like, surveys, focus groups? What would be one of the best or multiple ways for anyone, depending, of course, on the badges, to identify that? Is, first of all, asking to yourself and management, like, you know, who we are as a company, or should you ask everyone out there and then only after they identify? It's you know, it's a bit difficult sometimes. Like, do you start from inside or from the outside? What is the advice?
Well, I think you could do it either way. Having said that, I usually start from inside. I usually start with, why was this brand established in the first place? What makes it special? What made it unique when it first got on the scene? When were the moments of serious growth that were actually profitable growth, by the way, not just growth, but profitable growth? And can we identify who was coming in, who was transacting with us during those moments of really profitable growth? So I think it can totally start inside, and you have to be honest with yourself. It's okay to have an older demographic. It's okay to have a demographic that's looking for a deal. It's okay. You shouldn't be judgmental of who your target is. You just have to be aware of who the target is so you can be in the right places from a media standpoint, so you can build your pricing appropriately, so you can build your products appropriately, so you can make all the decisions you need to make. It becomes the filter for everything. So I personally think starting inside is smart. I do think if you're completely lost and you don't know what the brand is, you know, that's a basic market fit question. And at that point, you know, surveys could help you, external surveys. I've worked with companies before that have helped me, you know, define, can I creep into this psychographic place, or can I play in premium or play in luxury or whatever? But most of the time, you know, at Wendy's, at Papa John's, at Potbelly, we actually started with like, well, who loves this brand when it was at its best? And that gets you some clarification of what the brand should be. Anyone can drive some immediate transactions with discount. Anyone can. But I think that's a cheap way to market. I think some brands, if you're built around that, if you're Walmart, great. That's your model, is be low prices.
Yep.
If you're Amazon, that's a bit of your model, is accessibility and relatively low prices. But most companies, you know, you actually want to provide, you want to fit the needs that your ideal customer has. So I would much rather, you know, rather than constantly run discounts, I would much rather say the right things to the right people at the right time and see them show up. And usually that starts with, when was your brand at its best? And who was that customer?
Absolutely makes sense. I like when you said also, you know, the what makes like, you know, the brand special, or why was made it, you know, also what is unique. And on that, I also wanted to, you know, quote something else that you said in another interview about, you know, like the social lead, right? And you said that you should hire someone that is naturally fitting and matching with the brand values and image, right? Because people, as you said before, people don't even almost anymore buy in the brand, but it's in the personality, the person behind that, the type of like, you know, impact they have on society, you know, like, the same also for many brands. You follow sometimes the person that is like on their TikTok, for example, and because of that, you find new face and everything. So my question for you is, because of all that, right, and many brands are basically becoming media companies nowadays, right? All of them, they have to have their presence and understand social media. What would be the best way to hire, like to find a hire the right, you know, social lead for your brand?
Yeah, this is going to sound ridiculous, but the way I found all the best social leads that I've hired is I literally dig around on the platform that I know the ideal customer spends the most time on, and I find people who are popular and sound like the brand. And that seems strange, like, you know, stalking, you know, random comedians or journalists or whatever, but it at minimum defines your expectation for what you should sound like. So even if that individual is, you know, killing it on their own and doesn't want to work for you, you can find people that sound like that person. So you kind of, that it gives you a template to follow and find the people who are like it. I genuinely believe that a good social media lead can't fake it, not for very long. They just have to naturally sound a bit like what you want the brand to be. So, and sometimes it's an accident. Sometimes the brand ends up sounding like the person versus vice versa, which is okay as long as you're comfortable with that. But at the end of the day, you know, you take a brand like Wendy's that was the original, you know, call out competitors with Where's the Beef on television in the 80s. And I was looking for somebody who was willing to call other people out, looking for somebody who was snarky, looking for somebody who was not, you know, mean, but was aggressive enough to actually call out the competitors and expect higher standards. And as we dug, we found people who sound like that. We started hiring them. And an agency ultimately that hired somebody that sounded like it. So I genuinely think that's what you got to do is dig on the platform where your ideal customer spends time and find, like, I wish I could put my logo next to this post, whatever that post is. And then you dig into that person and see if they're willing. And if they're not willing, you find somebody else who sounds a lot like them. I don't think you just hire somebody with social media in their title and it magically works out. It's very, very rare that occurs.
a very smart approach, actually. I do see, like, you know, what I mean, right? They are already maybe doing something similar. It's similar to whenever you want to look for an influencer, right? You look for those people that are already organically, not even paid, talking well about your company, and then they already, like, love your product. They will be the perfect match, right, for you. And then if they get paid, you know, they will even do more deliverable. So I can see the concept of looking for that. And that's why also many content creators are actually being, you know, hired, right, as, let's say, chief creative officer, for example, in companies. They are the ones sometimes even more than managers in companies to understand what works and what doesn't in social media, right? That's why. So what is for you the influence factor? What makes like real influence on social media, and what makes a case studies or, you know, a campaign successful thanks to either influencers, content creators, or even just like social media in general?
Yeah, I think the primary factor is attention, I would argue. And I think attention comes within cultural fit. When there's a moment that you say the thing that culturally resonates, and everyone sort of feels it, like they understand it. It feels like it fits what people are asking for right now. So I think as a brand, what you should do is think about your unique offering, what makes you differentiated and interesting, and what culturally can you connect to that, you know, your ideal customer would celebrate and be interested in. I would argue it when we did that, when I've, you know, been very fortunate to work with brands that have been capable of doing that, that's been the magic, is that cultural moment of someone wants better, or someone is frustrated because the ice cream machine's busted at McDonald's, or someone's, you know, frustrated because their food wasn't very good, or whatever the thing is. You know, if you can tap into enough of a cultural impulse, you know, you can become the voice of that cultural moment. And I think that's what garners the most attention. So I really think it boils down to attention, but it's connected to culture.
Absolutely. It makes sense. You know, attention has been there, you know, since like the beginning of the, you know, society, I would say. And then when, you know, the iPhone came out, that was basically, okay, this is going to be like a revolution and everyone is going to be there all the time. So fighting for attention on social media, it's very important. So, and, you know, one of the, you know, last thing I wanted to ask you today is that you moved from, you know, the brand side, specifically in the restaurant, you know, food and bev, and then you went to the tech side. So I wanted to know from you, like, what are some of the most interesting differences that you noticed between these two so far away, I would say, you know, like worlds, right? One is brick and mortar, like, you know, with food and, you know, like real things that you can actually touch there and eat, yeah, and everything, while then it's a tech solution. So what, first of all, like, what, why of that, and what did you notice in differences?
Yeah, so, I mean, well, I'll start with the why and then I'll talk about the differences. So I've in my career probably invested $6 or $7 billion in media, maybe more than that at this point. So it's a lot over, you know, the last 12, 15 years of being a full-time marketer. And it frustrates me that I can probably account for 20 or 30% of the impact of that, you know, many billions of dollars. I think most marketers have to rely on gut a lot more than they should, especially when it comes to media investment. So for me, there is a giant opportunity for media companies, for technology companies, to clearly show how the dots connect between a marketing action and a business result on the back end. And sometimes it's complicated, like we talked about. First, you got to see those leading indicators or whatever. But when you get down to it, it shouldn't be as complicated as it is. And companies shouldn't have to just massively spend and hope that it's going to actually work. So I joined the tech side, the media / tech side, ad tech side, because someone needs to fix that. And I don't think Ground Truth is going to fix it all by itself, but I think Ground Truth has the technology to enable that visibility, those connections, because you have real world behaviors that you can measure. You can see whether or not you're affecting people's behavior with your marketing in relatively real time, so you can make good decisions. So the why is frustration about the way media works. I'm very proud of the growth that my companies have been able to accomplish and the teams that have driven that growth. But I do feel like a lot of it is gut, and that's not great. It should be a little more science than it is. There's art in creative, absolutely. There's art in messaging, absolutely. But to me, media should be much less art and much more science. And today, I would argue it's not. A lot of people are trying to solve that problem, but I wanted to be part of the solution. As far as how it's different, you know, I love being able to work with hundreds of companies and help them drive traffic or sales. So seeing kind of being behind the scenes on the media side, the technology side, I get to learn at like an exponential rate from what I had when I was running a company's marketing. I get to see hundreds of problems a week and help solve hundreds of problems a week and learn about what actually drives those real business results like foot traffic at a scale that I couldn't do before. So for me, it's very enlightening. Like I'm learning a lot. Every day I learn something at a rate that I didn't learn before, even though I was always, you know, companies. And because of that, I feel very vested in that cause of connecting the dots between what you're spending and what you're getting as a company, or what you're getting out of your marketing. The other, I think, big shift is, you know, the problems I was dealing with on the brand side were much longer term. You know, we had to solve a demographic issue at, you know, a couple of the brands I worked at. Those take years to solve. Oftentimes now, the problems we're solving take months to solve. It's literally like figure out how to better invest your dollars and reach the right audience and get them to react. So this pace is a lot different. And I love that about what I'm doing now. Will I go back to the brand side at some point? Very possibly, just because I love that part too. But it is really different to be behind the scenes and kind of see how the gears work and be able to influence those gears very quickly. It's a lot of fun. And I love helping marketers who need traffic, who need sales. I've been that guy where I had a really bad quarter and I need the next quarter to be better. And you need partners in the world that can help you accomplish those goals short term while you're working on the long term goals. If your sales start to decline and traffic is in trouble and you think because of it, your budget's going to be cut or your job's going to be in jeopardy, it would be great to be a partner and help you fix that problem. It's very exciting to do that right now.
I'm pretty sure you're learning a lot, you know, because again, you know, when you're like on the brand side, you learn a lot of micro things all on that brand though, right? While you work on the other side, you can like for us as an agency, right? Every day there are different verticals with different issues, with different challenges. You learn so much and then you get like all this knowledge and that next client you can help you because yeah, this already happened. Like in this industry, we already know how to fix it, right? Because you have the data.
Exactly. And I think it's valuable to learn both sides because I said it before, right? Solving long-term, getting long-term brand growth means you have to solve really big problems. Yeah, I would argue you can't solve in a quarter. You got to solve it over a year or two or three or longer. So I think learning both sides is really important because then you can actually identify them. Like you can see when something starts to happen, like I've seen this before. This is a longer-term problem that you should do X, Y, and Z to potentially tackle. In the meantime, we can do this that will give you some help. So I think both sides are really important to learn and understand.
To start wrapping up on the episode, I asked you like, you know, many things and you were like, you know, super late in getting back, like, you know, with, you know, a bunch of like, you know, metrics and, you know, money metrics and, you know, food travel. Like we talked about many different things, but is there anything that I didn't ask you today that you are either very excited about, something that you are studying closely? Is there something that I, you know, you would like to share with us today?
Yeah, I think the thing I'm most excited about that we haven't talked about is the merging of mediums right now. As a marketer, the toolbox has never been bigger. The ability to implement creative has never been faster and I would argue more effective. And because the production side is really fast now, everybody's got an iPhone in their hand and in theory can make something, right? The media is starting to catch up. When you see things like streaming ads and CTV and OTT and mobile and social, and then you have like product placement. The world will begin to merge from a media standpoint, I think over the next 5 or 10 years, like we don't even understand yet. I think in 10 years, we're going to be buying every medium basically programmatically, and we'll be able to do so at scale with testing through AI and other technologies that will immediately get us to the right person at the right time with the right message. So I think it's extremely exciting to be a marketer right now. And even more exciting that soon we're going to get rid of some of these stupid little problems we have, like segmentation of media type. We should not be debating TV versus digital anymore. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Part of the reason we still debate that is we don't have cohesive ways to distribute and measure the impact of those things. So that's super exciting for me, both on the media side and just as a marketer. It won't matter what you make. You can put it anywhere and it will work because it's to the right person. At the end of the day, the medium should be inconsequential. It should be about the person in front of that medium and the message you deliver as a marketer. That will make marketing much more pure and I think much more effective.
Wow. Very interesting point of view on this, like not just on the medium, but the recipient and, you know, like the, yeah, there are like, you know, tens of years of like, you know, studies, right, about like the medium and who is receiving the messages and the message that they're like, anyone that studied marketing business know what I'm referring to, right? But a big one, right, that you're talking about. I'm very curious also to see what is gonna happen. But I do agree, like we have to find different ways than now, because right now it's still confusing many times, and it shouldn't be.
It should be easy. It should be about getting to an effect and getting in front of the right person. And I think we're going to get there in the next 5 or 10 years. We're getting close.
I do agree. Well, Brandon, thank you so much for joining me today. Congratulations on your career so far. Best of luck, you know, for what you're building. Very curious to see what you're going to do in a few years. I will definitely follow you on that. And yeah, again, thank you so much for sharing all your knowledge with us today.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Amazing. This was The Influence Factor by The Influencer Marketing Factory, and I'll see you next week.